Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today is Joe Rinaldi, a connector and business owner from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Joe, hi.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming on the show. I'm just checking my audio settings again. Yes, good. We're on the good mic. Okay, I'm paranoid now. I did a whole show and like somehow the wrong mic was on and the shame is like never goes away. So Joe.
That was a good show though. I listened to that show with Jason Fried. That was great.
Yes, but the audio was shameful. I mean, the audio just sounded like put a mic in a dog's butt and that's how it was recorded. Joe, you are the founder of Philomade.
I was.
You were. You were at Happy Cog for 5 years and 8 months where we worked together.
Indeed.
As a business development person. Hmm. You are an adjunct professor at Drexel University, and you're the owner and business development consultant of That Was Clutch, a company you founded in 2016. Tell me about That Was Clutch.
Sure.
Sorry.
After my...
Got a cold,
No, absolutely. I understood. After I wrapped up my time at Happy Cog and had spent so much time in business development and had been kind of working with lots of agency owners through a conference series that Happy Cog put together called Owner Camp, just realized there were lots and lots of people working in client services who were confused, intimidated by, terrified of business development. Just this was an under-exercised muscle for lots of people. And, you know, I just had more reps. I had 6 years of this under my belt. I had a lot more kind of time on the front lines. And I started just bringing some of what I'd learned to those folks. And now, 2.5 years later, working with nearly 40 companies,
wow.
It's that snowball effect. I think that most of what I talk to people about now is related to what I've learned over the last 2.5 years, and very little of it is tied to my experience, practically speaking, at Happy Cog anymore. So it's just this right. kind of accumulation of stuff I've learned along the way. And that stuff validates a lot of what, you know, you probably suspect about business development or what I thought about business development. I feel like I have a little bit more validation that some of these things hold true in many environments. And what I suspect is true has actually been borne out to be true with lots of agencies.
You're a connector. Like my friend Liz Danzigo, you seem to just know everybody. And you have the ability to put yourself in the point of view of the person you're talking to and also the person they're going to be talking to. Negotiation, turns out, is not something that a lot of creative people are super comfortable with. So, you know, the skills that make you a good designer, good mm-hmm. developer, good founder, don't necessarily make you good in these kind of difficult business conversations. And you seem to be able to do it in a way, advise in a way that's beneficial and non-judgmental and fun. Mm-hmm. And I know for a fact, I have basically two gigs as a result of just talking to you, right?
Oh, that's very kind of you to say.
And also I have a much better framework for making decisions than I had 2 years ago before we started having these weekly conversations. So how do you get clients and what do you do with clients to try to, so people can have some kind of understanding of what a day is like being Joe Rinaldi?
Sure. So I think to your previous point, I think that part of the challenge in business development for designers, for developers, for people that run agencies is realizing that a lot of the skills they use in their work, specifically empathy, is incredibly valuable in their client interactions. And I think that people feel sometimes overly guarded in their client interactions. They feel that there's less margin for error. They want to be super careful. They yes. wind up, you know, overthinking. And I do think that if they can use this, you know, empathy they've built up over time by listening and learning and doing their research, then it's welcome in the sales process. So that's honestly, if I'm good at what I do, it's only because my mother taught me to be a very active listener and put myself in other people's shoes and, you know, kind of bring that to the context I have in a conversation.
And it rubs off on the people that you help, I'll say. So
very, very cool.
You listen to me, you give me the space to talk, and then I find myself listening to the person that I had been talking to you about and giving them space in the same way. I think it's almost like, you know how you teach your kids partly by talking to them and telling them, but a lot of it's just modeling behavior. Like if you smoke cigarettes and tell your kids not to smoke, guess what? They're going to smoke. You can model good and bad behavior. We do it as parents all the time. I think you model a lot of good behavior in the way that you consult, and it rubs off. And for me, I do like when I feel, I like talking to a client and feeling like I'm just talking to a person, almost like I'm on a train with a person, and I, you know, I want to be helpful. I want to be engaging. I want to hear what they have to say, but I don't feel like I'm tricking them or tricking money out of them, or, you know, there's so much negativity that comes out of, I mean, most of us that have gone into something like design, it wasn't necessarily what your parents were hoping you would do. Right. It's right. And so there's, and you enjoy what you do. So the fact that you also get paid for something you enjoy, there's probably guilt with that too. Cause if you've had other jobs, you know, a lot of times you get paid for having a miserable time. That's why you're getting paid.
Yeah. Right. Now that's, I watched my dad was a pipe fitter. You know, this was backbreaking work my whole life. And it's, you know, I didn't conceive that this kind of job even existed because that wasn't my frame of reference. I just thought, you know, you got paid more the harder your work was. And I do think, I try to be very mindful of how lucky I am that I get to do what I do and, you know, do the kind of work that I do. But I agree with you entirely. I think that part of what I think rubs off on people, the more we talk about sales or negotiating or business development, is to be yourself and to be authentic and sincere and to let your personality shine through, some vulnerability, like just to be generous in that way, I think is really powerful. But then I think you need to kind of match that with some intent. You have to kind of have an idea for where you want the conversation to go. Once you imagine the destination, you're a heck of a lot more likely to get there. So I think sometimes we go into, I knew this for myself. Let me not project this on other people, but in my early formative years in business development at Happy Cog, you know, I was going into these client interactions with the client on a pedestal, trying to take the best notes, to listen the best, to extract all the best information and get rewarded for, you know, good behavior, get patted on the head because I took the best notes and I was the best person in the meeting and all of that. And it took time to grow into some confidence where I could be more myself and I could let more of my personality come through and I could be more. And then I also got to a point where I understood, you know, I can move us closer to the finish line. If I, you know, say this thing, or I offer this thing, or I suggest this thing, I can kind of drag us towards the finish line rather than hoping upon hope with my fingers crossed that if I just, you know, do all the right things, the client will drag us to the finish line. That was a big part of just, you know, gaining enough experience to learn that. And I think you have to kind of learn that lesson the hard way. It's hard for you to take that on faith if you don't see that through your own experience.
That's really interesting. I do think people who are good at sales understand the wishes. Like, let's take it out of the realm of design for a minute. If I'm going to buy an engagement ring, they sort of gauge how excited are these people, how serious are they, what do they want to buy, what are they afraid to buy, what can I sell them that will really make them happy, because it's about making them happy. And I think the same is true if you're buying a new trumpet or guitar or something, right? The salesperson has to know, how serious is this student? How long have they been practicing? Do they think they're going to go to Carnegie Hall, or is this something they do with their friends in the garage? Right.
And your example of the engagement ring is perfect, because as a salesperson, I would imagine, you realize this person is experiencing something that they've never experienced before, and they're very unlikely ever going to experience again. They're experiencing something completely unique, this like desire to get engaged. But you, as a salesperson, you deal with people in this context every day.
Right.
You live in that space. You understand that, you know, they're worried about things they're never going to be worried about again, or they're thinking about things they're never going to think about again. And once you can put yourself very firmly in that person's shoes and understand the pressure they're under, the excitement they're feeling, whatever, all those complicating things, you can speak to them in a language they can understand because you are treating it seriously enough, or you're excited enough about it, or you're whatever that is, like whatever that is that you can like demonstrate to them, shows them like, oh, this person like totally gets all the things that are racing through my head right now. And I feel safe making a decision influenced by this person because we're both on the same side of this thing. We're not on other sides of the fence, you know, duking this out. This person's kind of on my side of the fence.
They're showing that they're excited like I am.
Right.
They're empathetic. Right. They're not some sociopath. They're not just going next. I'm really, you know, I need my commission next. They're giving me time. They're making me feel relaxed, which I think more and more is a huge part of everything that we do, giving our clients time, giving the reader and the user time. And then the other thing that I think, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but I get it from the way you interact with me, and I've been using it in my interactions with clients, just confidence, because I want to feel that the salesperson's excited, but I don't want to feel like they're like, oh my God, what if you buy the wrong ring? That's my job. Yeah. I'm supposed to worry about that. They're not. Just like, I want my doctor to look at me and go, this is, you know, we do this surgery all the time. Your chances are very good.
Yeah.
I want them to be empathetic. They shouldn't be like, hey, what's the big deal? I'm going to cut off your leg. You know, you got to.
Right.
But at the same time, I also don't want them going agonizing with me, because then I don't trust them. I have to put myself in their hands. I think like going to the dentist is another weird metaphor for being a client, right? Where you open your mouth and you let them give you gas, and then and you drift off a little bit, and then they sort of tap you and go, okay, wider. And you come out of some dream state and like open your mouth wider, and you're trusting that they're not going to like surprise you with like selling your teeth on the black market or filing them down to me monster teeth. They're going to, you know, they're going to take care of you. I think we talk about collaboration with clients, and that's important too, but there's definitely, we don't want to abdicate our responsibility. Do you know what I'm saying?
Agreed. So, I think bees, dogs, and clients can smell fear.
Yes.
Like it comes, it is a stinky cologne. It comes off you in waves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, sometimes you have to talk yourself into confidence. Sometimes you're just walking in with lots of confidence. But I agree with you, Jeffrey. I think that people buy people. Like, and usually, 90% of the time, they buy people that make them feel safe. 10% of the time, they might buy from someone that inspires them or makes them feel like it's a little like a fun risk. Like they're excited about that sometimes.
Yes.
But by and large, I think
like their Coke dealer.
Exactly. I think most people are more comforted and realize, you know, whatever, this is a major budget that I'm spending on this initiative. And for me, the client, this reflects on my career and my ability to get promoted or my ability to, you know, do another project like this down the road. I want to get this right. And nine times out of 10, it's that safety that people fear that really draws them in. And that's as much like a personal chemistry and connection you have as it is, we have this process that's, you know, tried and true. We have these results that you can put a lot of faith in. We have these case studies and testimonials and all this track record we bring to this that you can invest a lot of faith in.
But the wrong person making that point, I'm 100%. Not going to buy it, right? I'm
100%.
Not, you know, or, you have all these case studies, but I'm not, somehow I don't feel like they're yours.
Yeah. Or that person, you know, they've been doing this so long that they've kind of emotionally checked out a little bit and they're not as present as they once were. Like all those things are perceptible by clients.
It's so very emotional. It's very interpersonal. I read a novel by my old writing teacher, John Casey, and he was making fun of some these characters. There were sort of these boring characters and they're married. Yeah. And one says, love is an interpersonal equation. And the other one starts singing, love is an interpersonal equation, like making fun of how unromantic and silly that is.
Right.
But I do think what we do is that. What we do is It's relationship stuff. And again, I think, well, do you think maybe it's just because you're like a working class Philly guy? Do you think that, you know, born working class Philly guy, do you think that helps you just get to the truth and be real with people and not put on fake airs?
I think that's part of it. I think part of it is when I started in this industry, I didn't know what the secret language was of, you know, 15, 20 years of working in a creative space. And I think that's sometimes mistaken for authenticity, but it's also is probably equal parts ignorance on my part. So I think I was,
you mean buzzwordy stuff? I mean, when people talk, exactly. Like, yeah, I hate exactly. that. I always hated that.
Exactly. That I always, think I just didn't have that in my vernacular. Like I just didn't, I wasn't able to say those things. So what I said tended to be a little bit more perceived as personal or, you know, maybe even idiosyncratic. I remember, one, there was a project we did at Happy Cog many, many moons ago with Ben and Jerry's. And early in the sales process, the client was lovely. The client was awesome. And in the first phone call, I knew I wanted to work with Katie O'Brien at Ben and Jerry's. She was just amazing. And it's a big, they're owned by Unilever though. Like there's a lot of moving parts around a decision that Ben and Jerry's would make. And I was very guarded in the way that we engage. And I was trying to be very deliberate and professional. And I remember at one point I turned to Brett Harned, who sat next to me, and I'm like, you know, screw it. I'm just going to like be myself and see what happens. And I, she wrote me an email and I wrote her back and said, oh my God, I was just thinking about you and you emailed me. I'm going to now say pizza and hope that one gets delivered magically as well. And she emailed back like, that's hilarious. And da, 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 da. And everything changed. Everything changed.
Yes.
Like all of the little, you know, all the guard was let down. There was, and it was an amazing amount of just like honesty that she was willing to provide. And it all turned out great. And it was just because I took a flyer on that. And then from there on, like that was always what I was trying to remind myself was, and this was a mistake I made too. So I want to say this and then I want to quickly correct myself because then I became very focused on being myself, you know, kind of bringing my, the best version of myself to every call, to every meeting, to every pitch. And really,
so it
got to
fake
a point
again.
Where 100%, it became performance art. It got to a point where it was like, it was more important for me to walk into a meeting where there were four people from Happy Cog there, including myself. But I wanted to go in and win the meeting with the client. I wanted to win that pitch. I wanted to get that guy to laugh, and I wanted to get that woman to stop looking at her phone. I wanted to get that person to kind of lean forward. And if I could do all that and I could win that meeting, I felt like we would win the work or we would win the project or whatever. And what I realized was what was much more effective and much more honest to the way that that team worked was if I could like sit back a little bit and instead be a ringmaster and kind of get my team to respond instead of me. So I would say things like, you know, hey, that's a really interesting question. You know, and I would turn to like Patrick Marseille or somebody and say, Patrick, like, could you share that example from client XYZ where we did that? And then when Patrick would answer this question, I realized how much more powerful it was for the client to fall in love with the team than to fall in love with me. I go away. I was the biz dev guy, you know, like I'm here to make sure we get off on the right foot. And then I kind of go away. But if you fall in love with R.S. Seltzer or Justenia Perez Cruz or Ryan Ireland or whoever, you know, you're never going to leave once you meet these people and see them at their best. And that was like a real breakthrough for me too, was to realize the more effective thing was not to overperform. It was really to kind of delegate and serve other people up at the right moment. And they would kill it. They would kill it every time.
I love that. It's funny. You do that as a biz dev. I do that as creative director. I was just telling a client, like, basically, you don't even need me here. I do as they say, what do you do? I say, I'm the creative director. I do as little as possible. And it wasn't just like a self-deprecatory joke. It was true. I learned, Orson Welles said, and I don't know if it was truthful because I think he's a guy that would say things that sounded awesome, whether they were true or not, because they
I think
would
Orson
be like,
knew who Orson was.
He knew his brand. He wanted to say something bigger than life. Yeah. But he said, when they asked him about his directing, which, you know, was unlike any other, he was he was basically an independent filmmaker in Hollywood in 1939 that was unheard of. And he failed as a result because they didn't really like that. But he didn't say, I keep a dream journal and smoke opium and, you know, or whatever might have actually been going on. If there was, he didn't say that. He said, well, I hire a great screenwriter. I hire terrific actors. We get a great composer and a great set designer, and we make sure that we have a great cinematographer. And then I do as little as possible. And I thought, yeah, I don't buy it completely, but that is actually the right way to do it. I've also heard Alfred Hitchcock used to fall asleep while directing his films a lot of times, or he'd say, you were like 2 seconds late, or can you move a little to the left? But he didn't. And they said, well, how come you aren't telling the actors how to act? He said, well, they're actors. They know how to act. You know, the script writer did their job. It's their motivation's clear. If they need to, they could ask me, but they know what they're doing. I think I really tried. I've worked for creative directors that really micromanaged and learned a lot from them, but was never happy. And I've had others that trusted me. And when I was an irresponsible jackass, that wasn't a great idea either. But in between, when I actually became good at what I was doing, trusting me was the best call. And I try to do that with people. And I do that with clients too. I try to let it come out. Let the story come out, not lead it. Like we're doing now. I mean, you're doing most, I have a show where I basically have other people talk.
I think it takes you have to arrive at that place though, right? Where you can kind of operate that way. There's a friend of mine who runs an agency. His name is Richard Banfield. And he said at one point, just kind of in passing, like didn't even like think this was a remarkable thing to say, but he said, you know, if someone can do something 75% as well as you can do it, delegate to them. Like they don't have to be able to do it as well as you can do it. But if you don't delegate to them at some point, they're never going to learn. So you have to be kind of generous with that. And you also have to have kind of the courage to delegate to people because people that take things very seriously. And I've seen this with designers and I've seen this with developers and I've seen this with people that work in business development, that seriousness or the importance of that can lead to a lot of just being kind of a control freak, just wanting to control every variable, wanting to make sure that every I is dotted, every T is crossed, you know, everything is pinpoint precise. And if you hold things up to that kind of scrutiny, then, you know, interesting things don't happen. You know, like you're squeezing the serendipity out of things too.
It's by good for a moon landing. Everything.
Right? It is. Absolutely. 100%. That's a good point. If you're building a suspension bridge, then
no
that's
improv.
That's a good attribute to have.
Exactly. No improv.
Exactly. But this is alchemy. Like client services is there. It's not science. It's a lot of soft tissue, you know, people to people stuff. There's a lot of science that goes into it. There's a lot of sound reasoning that is applied, but you know, this is a lot of, it's just alchemy. It's a lot of
the client
figuring it out in the context.
The client has to see themselves in the work. Otherwise they don't, somehow it was wrong. And the customer has to see themselves in the work.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's wrong. If I'm using something and it feels foreign to me, just, and I never wrap my brain around it.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I don't know why, but I just don't like it. And I'm not saying that in design, the main thing is the research and identifying the problem and finding the best solution for the problem. But that said, if in addition to doing that, you also have to do it in a way where the people feel like they contributed, and and you really can't do it unless they did contribute. And if you hide their contribution, they won't like it and they'll start over. Even if what you built works perfectly well.
Yep.
They'll start over.
I've never seen someone do that as well as Josh Clark does it. I worked on a project with Josh, and I never before, never since have I seen someone so elegantly recruit the clients into the process while still leading. Like he didn't just kind of forfeit the process to them and let them run roughshod, but just this ability to kind of just feather them in, just kind of layer them into what's already happening. So they felt they were recruited into it. And you're right. Like they felt this investment, they built this. So when Josh takes his medicine show and goes over the hill to the next small town for the next project, there's a heck of a lot better chance that the work he did is going to stick because the people feel like their fingerprints are all over it too. We co-authored this.
And they are. I mean, I've pitched,
I've pitched
with them. It's genuine. Because we, you know, we write down what they're saying. We make storyboards. We use sticky notes. We do all those things. So at the end of the day, people are like, okay, my decisions are informing this. I mean, again, and it gets back to that sales thing of there's a guy, Al. When I go to San Francisco, I try to go to Al's Attire and get a suit made for my strange little body, which
I'm right there with you.
Strangely enough, that's not, I mean, I think most men's clothing is designed for a different ethnicity, maybe even a different species.
Yeah.
Certainly a different height, different weight, all this other stuff. But this guy doesn't make me feel like I'm some freak. He makes me feel like I have measurements. And I always feel like I'm designing the suit. Now, Al is really, he's a bespoke tailor. He brings out materials. We talk about them. We talk about buttons and things. I feel like I'm the designer, but he's the designer. Mm-hmm. But he's a brilliant designer because I always feel like I'm wearing something that I made.
Yeah.
And I think that is a knack in our industry. But so these are not skills, by the way. You went to Savannah College of Art and Design.
I did.
Great school.
Yep.
Did they teach you anything like what we're talking about today, though? Because my experience is that these kinds of skills aren't taught in programs. Maybe that's changing, but...
No, I feel like what prepared me was the combination of both what I studied at SCAD and what I studied undergrad. I went to University of Richmond in Virginia, and I was a leadership studies major. So I took my leadership studies major, which really studied like the theory of building consensus and servant leadership and various forms of just generating momentum in a certain direction. And so it was a really odd combination of studying illustration at SCAD for 3 years, which gave me some of the, you know, design thoughtfulness I needed to have to be able to just behave in this industry. And then that coupled with my undergrad experience in leadership studies, it's the combination of those two things that I think are important. But honestly, I believe very firmly what Mike Montero kind of subscribes to. And Mike's very kind of famous for adhering to this. He would claim, you know, time and time again, that he would never hire someone to work at Mule if they hadn't worked in customer service in some capacity, hadn't waited tables or worked in retail or done some of that. That's me, man. Like, I've always waited tables. My mother was the head of customer service for a large credit card company. I would work in collections on the phone in the summers. And like, it was a combination of, you know, I did some retail, I did some waiting tables, I did on the phone customer service with, you know, people that were afraid of talking to their credit card company because they'd missed a payment and all of that, like frontline kind of stuff. I worked, you know, the information desk at Barnes & Noble for 2 years while I was in SCAD. So I think a lot of it is that accumulated knowledge too, you know, like just how to work with people, how to listen, how to, you know, disarm something that was a thorny situation and think on your feet. You know, I love it when people talk about taking their team to like improv training. It's happened sometimes. You hear like agency owners talk about like, oh, we had our retreat this week and, you know, we decided to bring in someone to do some like improv training and teach our folks how to kind of think on their feet. If you haven't, you know, worked on the front lines of customer service like that, that's a hard skill to build if you don't have that kind of practical experience. But I don't think SCAD prepared me for that part of it. I think SCAD gave me the ability to have an intelligent conversation with somebody about, you know, color theory and you know, this is cropped too tight here and the image has too much kind of tension in this area. Like, it gave me the vocabulary to talk design in a way.
Well, I think it gave you the aesthetic tools.
Right.
But I mean, I worked in restaurants too, and I wouldn't. And I also played in bands.
And I think bands are another great example is that kind of performing on stage, being in a band, being in an ensemble. Like, there's a lot of lessons you learn there too. You took the words out.
Listening to other people and like, you know, somebody makes a mistake and then you all make it together.
Right.
It's not a mistake anymore. It's like the best part of the song now.
Right.
Stuff like that. And I think with Montero, I think part of that is just a bias toward if people have had it too easy, if they've never had a job that was hard, they're not going to fully appreciate what they've got at this job.
100%.
Right?
100%.
Even very occasionally, I can remember at Happy Cog, once or twice, maybe, having someone who they'd only done design and they'd only mm-hmm. done design at Happy Cog. And so they didn't really know, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, most places don't really give you this big education stipend every year. Most places don't let you take a week off to go to a conference. You're like, that's yeah. not normal. That's not normal. Yeah. And yet there are places that might pay you better. And, you yeah. know, check that out. But there are places, not that many places let you take the lead. You know,
I thought that Allison Wagner was a front-end developer at Happy Cog while I was there the whole time. She's probably who I owe my job to more than anybody getting me into Happy Cog. But Allison had worked waiting tables. She'd worked for like really different, not as optimal agencies before. She had like, you know, in her early career, really, you know, shoveled oh, yeah. through some bad stuff to
I
get
like
to.
That. I like that verb. I worked at some really suboptimal ad agencies early in my career.
Yeah.
And with people, I worked for dishonest creative directors who'd say like, who'd give you a strategy that couldn't possibly work because they wanted to ride in like heroes to justify that they earned three times as much as you. Right.
She had done all this work for like, ad agency that worked with casinos. And she had seen all of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes in driving people to go gamble at casinos. Like,
oh my.
She'd seen the underbelly of all of that. So she was, as a result, like one of the most authentically present people at Happy Cog, like appreciated everything, understood the value of everything. And when stuff would go sideways, when like we'd have like a bad client day or some bad news would come in or whatever, like she never blinked. This is not that bad, y'all, compared to,
right.
you know, somebody else is having a much worse day than we are right now. Like, this is not that bad. And I think you have to have that. That has to be like in your experience for you to be able to, you know, weather something like that.
And I worked at a place great. The founder of the company was 19 when he founded it. It was we call them startups now. It was a .com. And he was a mm-hmm. great, great guy, super creative, really nice, very smart, successful, but he'd never had a crummy job in his life. He'd yeah. never been a security guard. He'd never had to paint something. I had a job scraping asbestos, and it was a day before the owner said, "Why aren't you wearing goggles?" For a whole day, I was scraping asbestos into my eyeballs, going, "Man, this hurts." I came home and my dad said, "That's carcinogenic, you know." Yeah. Over, you know, we're eating chicken, and my dad's like telling me I'm going to get cancer of the eyeballs. I'm just like, but like, if you've had jobs like that, then the client didn't like my idea. Is yeah. you know, well then go get a better idea.
Yeah,
you know what?
Yeah. Aaron Draplin talks about that a lot in his. I've seen him, you know, present before. And he talks about like, you know, go dig holes for a day, man. Like,
yeah.
Go do that work, like, and then realize, you know, just how different it is to be able to have these kinds of problems. And I think, you know, it's everybody has their own context, but right. I think it's, yeah.
No, and I'm not saying that creative problems or a frustrating meeting isn't a challenge emotionally, but yeah, we are very blessed to have worked our way into whatever piece of this creative work that we do. I'm going to take a quick sponsor break. You get yourself a drink of water, and I'm going to thank two organizations that have made it possible for this show to run today. The first is HoneyBook. Do you own a small business? Are you frustrated by dealing with back and forth emails, endless paperwork, and the struggle of just trying to get paid? HoneyBook.com can help you spend less time handling the administrative work and more time doing what you love. HoneyBook is an all-in-one business management platform for creative small businesses. HoneyBook makes it easy to streamline your process with client and calendar management tools and custom branded brochures, proposals, and contracts. You can even get e-signatures, generate invoices, and get paid faster, all within one online system. Over 75,000 photographers, designers, event professionals, and other solo entrepreneurs have saved hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. I'm going to start that one again. Over 75, man, it's hard today. Over 75,000 photographers, designers, event professionals, and other solo entrepreneurs have saved hundreds, if not thousands, of hours a year with HoneyBook. And that's why we've partnered with HoneyBook.com to offer Big Web Show listeners 50% off the first year of HoneyBook with promo code Big Web Show. So get started at HoneyBook.com today and use promo code Big Web Show for 50% off your first year. Again, That's honeybook.com, promo code Big Web Show. The Big Web Show is also brought to you by Green Chef. What is Green Chef? Green Chef is a USDA certified organic company that makes eating well easy and affordable with plans to fit every kind of lifestyle. How Green Chef works. Green Chef lets you choose from a wide array of easy-to-follow lifestyles with selected organic ingredients. Recipes are quick. That's got to be a copy error. Green Chef lets you choose from a wide array of easy-to-follow recipes with select organic ingredients. Recipes are quick and easy to follow with step-by-step instructions, chef tips, and photos to guide you along. Everything's hand-picked and delivered right to your door. Ingredients come pre-measured, perfectly proportioned, and mostly prepped. It's really true. I'm very lazy. I hate cooking. And I'm a Green Chef customer. It totally works for me. And there's lots of different kinds. With Green Chef, it's easy to eat well and discover new recipes every week. You can switch up your meal plan when you're ready to try a new way to eat. And with their wide variety of high-quality, clean ingredients, you can feel great about what you're eating and how it got to your table. Meal plans include paleo, vegan, vegetarian, pescatarian, Mediterranean, heart smart, lean and clean, keto, gluten-free, and omnivore. Now, when my daughter grows up and moves on to college, I will try pescatarian and vegetarian. But for now, we are a vegan household because my daughter's a vegan. And man, it's great. And they don't do the thing. Sometimes people say they're being vegan, but they make everything seem like cheese. And, you know, I don't think people who want to eat vegan don't really want disguised food that seems like something else. They don't really want vegan food that tastes like animals. They really want vegan food that tastes like fresh, healthy vegetables, plants, protein. And it really works. It's been very nice so far. They design flavorful recipes for your lifestyle that go way beyond ordinary substitutions. It's a diverse array of meal plans with plenty of options to choose from each week. And you enjoy clean ingredients you can trust, which are seasonally sourced for peak freshness. What do I have today? I'm not sure. I'm going to be making a Green Chef meal plan later today. With cauliflower. The last thing I had was Sloppy Joe's. They were amazing. My kid's a super picky eater. She probably wouldn't like me talking about her. I apologize. But she is. And we have not had a complaint yet. In a previous meal plan, there was a lot of stuff where it was like, yeah, no, not so much. Everything's delicious. It's seasoned nicely. It's not over-seasoned. It's not over-salted. It's not over-spiced. It's really, really good. I'm very happy with them, and I'm very glad to have them as a sponsor. And you will be very glad to try them for $50 off your first box of Green Chef. Go to greenchef.us/bigwebshow. That's greenchef.us/bigwebshow. For $50 off your first box of Green Chef. Yay! Okay. Thank you, sponsors. And with that, we are back with Joe Rinaldi, founder of Clutch. He's here to chew gum and make friends. Joe, your clients include Upstatement, Super Friendly, Fun Size, Sparkbox, Dynamo, Adorable, Plank, Gistia, Eastern Standard, Four Kitchens, Cumbia, Bakla Group, Neo... Did I say that right? Baca Group. I'm going to stop now. Three Advance, Yellow Pencil, South Left, Good Work. You stop me anytime. Telegraph, Armor, Maven Communications, The Star Conspiracy, Ibeck Creative, Adorable, Columna, Studio Zeldman, Assemble, Pixel and Tonic, Chromatic. Yeah. So how did you, you must have started with one client, I assume.
I did. And I'm very grateful to the kind folks. It was kind of a tie. My first client was either Upstatement or Cumbia, depending on how you want to kind of slice that one way or the other. But yeah, I mean, it was in the early days, it was validating to kind of work with some clients and prove that my hypothesis, that some of what I was thinking, you know, in my own head was valuable to folks. And they were very kind to give me my first couple of opportunities at this and very forthcoming with their feedback. And I improved my process tremendously based on, you know, my reps with both of them. I think it was also really validating that I think in both cases, I wound up working with each of them over the course of the following 2 years. Like it wasn't just like a one and done, you know, burn that bridge. It didn't work out well the first time. It turned into a really long relationship with folks. So yeah, I mean, it was massive that they were willing to give that a shot, because then that gave me a chance to, you know, do my own biz dev and take my own medicine and reach out to folks and develop conversations that would turn into projects over a very long interval of time. You know, it's rare you reach out to somebody and they say, oh, thank goodness, you know, I have $100,000 burning a hole in my pocket today. And that's a bad example. My products don't cost nearly that much, but just you have to play the long game, develop the dialogue with folks, you know, kind of get the relationship off the ground. And then when the stars line up, you're ready to collaborate on a project.
Well, and you and I talked about that early on when I was setting up my studio. We talked about like just having lunch with people. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. You know, reach out to an old client. Don't ask them for anything. Don't say, hey, you got a gig because I'm starving? No. You just say, hey, how you been?
And that's,
you want to have lunch?
I think there's the thing that I've witnessed the most in the past year, like the last year in particular, that I've diagnosed that is the most valuable thing that people can do in business development are improving their account management. So improving their existing relationship with paying clients, just, you know, extracting as much value as is appropriate out of people that are already working with you, that already trust you, that are already happy with the work that you do.
Right.
And the other is exactly what you said. I call it mining old gold. It's finding all of those people in your Rolodex that, you know, you've just lost touch with, or it's been a while since you connected, and you generate recency bias. You just cultivate recency bias by engaging with them, talking to them, emailing them, having lunch with them, having coffee with them. You push your card to the front of their mental card catalog. And you also make sure that like all of the information on that card is accurate, because it may have been 4 years since they heard from you, and they have a very different impression of what you're up to that is not related to today's reality. So just, you know, engaging in that conversation with people in a thoughtful way allows them to refer you more successfully, or come to you when they have the right kind of project, or, you know, just find the right opportunities for those stars to line up. Because, you know, the enemy of business development for many people like you is not that I haven't heard of you. Like you have a huge network. You've you know, worked with and met thousands of people. That's not your enemy, is I haven't heard of you. It is, the enemy is, oh, I had this thing like 4 months ago and we wound up just doing it internally because I didn't realize you did that kind of work, or I didn't realize you were available for that kind of work, or I just didn't think of you at the time. That's the enemy, is a client not drawing the right conclusion at the right time that you are the perfect person to reach out to do this work. And, you know, it's because humans are imprecise machines. And as time passes, you know, you just may not be front of mind for them anymore, or they may associate you with work you don't do anymore, or not realize you do the work that they need to hire for. So I think exactly what you did when you started to reach out to people and have coffee or have lunch or just spark that conversation, you know, you weren't walking into that expecting that person to have a massive project that they brought to lunch with them. The goal was, you know, if I can re-engage with this person every 4 or 6 months for the next 2 years and just say hello and check back in and develop the relationship, that just gives me 2 years of opportunity for the stars to line up, for this, you know, the clouds to part and for there to be a project.
That's so smart, and it reminds me of it. It's why Coca-Cola advertises. It's not that nobody's ever heard of Coca-Cola.
Right.
It's right. Like the That's reason they're point. In every movie theater, because maybe it's been 20 minutes since I thought of having a Coke.
Yeah.
But just remind me that it's out there. That's all. You know, they don't have to talk about the qualities of the beverage or what's in it or anything, because everybody knows.
Right? And I think that example is really apt, because just like people have developed over the past, you know, 100 years, a resistance to advertising, just because it's just something you socially start to understand how to be, you know, train yourself to be a little blind to advertising. So advertisers have to work harder to kind of break through that.
Plus, you know, on the web, it's a nightmare. It's like the thing at the top of the, you know, it's in the right rail. It's at the top. Yep. It's all these places that I've trained myself not to look. Yep. In fact, if you want to hide Jimmy Hoffa, you put him in the ad slot on a web page.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Nobody will ever look there.
Yeah, because you've built that resistance like a callus over time, and as a result, because people as a survival instinct, build up this callus towards being marketed at, or build this callus towards being presented information that they don't seek themselves. Like, you really have to disrupt that. And the best way to disrupt that is through sincerity and authenticity, honest to God. Like, it's not to write cheese ball drip campaigns and, you know, marketed content and blah, blah, blah,
blah.
Oh
my gosh.
Really just about, like,
if I get one more email from a stranger that begins, "I'm going to give this just one more try."
And oh, like, my God.
"Look, we both know you're busy." I'm like, "Oh my God, you didn't even alter the template." Like, that's the default. That's the default template. But what you're saying, by the way, is also good for people who are seeking a job. Yes, what you're saying is good for the agency that's looking for new clients from mining its old gold. Yes, what you're saying is great for freelancers who are looking to reconnect with old clients because, you know, they may mine old gold, as you said. But it's also just good for people who are looking for a job because your friends, just looking people up again, you may find that you know people and they're like, "You know what? I forgot you do this. Listen, we're looking to hire someone who does that." Yep. Or, "I had 100%. No idea you'd switch. Wait, you used to be in graphic design. Now you're in UX. I didn't know that. I thought you were a developer. You've moved over to research. I didn't know that." Well,
yep.
We need a researcher. I mean, that stuff happens. So
yeah. As someone who, prior to getting into business development, I worked as a recruiter at Aquint for 6 years.
Great company, by the way.
Great company, Vitamin T. I know that you're long
them.
Friends with those folks. Yeah, they do great
them.
Work. But I know that lots of people, you're exactly right. Freelancers, people looking for jobs, often subscribe to the idea of, you know, if I do good things and I do good work, someone will notice eventually. And that's not wrong. I do think that good work is the best business development. It is, fundamentally.
But
hope is not a plan.
Hope is not a plan.
You know, that's Dusty Gullison said that. He runs a company called eResources, and I agree with it entirely. I think the best thing you could do is exactly what we were talking about. If you're trying to get a new job, the best thing you can do in a lot of cases is reconnect with the people that you already know. You know, just push your little card to the front of their mental Rolodex, get them updated on what you're doing now, what your current skills are, what you're passionate about, all of that, and go into those meetings confident, being yourself, and with an intention. Like, have an intent. Have an intent at the end of this where it's, "You know what I'd really love? I'd really love to have coffee with Jeffrey. And at the end of the coffee, you know, if he understood how passionate I am about doing this work in this space, if he were to, like, refer me to somebody that he knows that's hiring for that, that's what I want to come out of this lunch. I want that to come out of this coffee." Like, just have that in mind.
I mean, it feels dirty in a way, but, you know, when we talk to our clients, we say, like, "What do you want people to do with your app? What do you want people to do with your website?" They don't go, "Oh, I don't know. I just thought we'd make something because it's nice. I have a budget, so I thought I'd spend it." Nobody, I mean, I'm sure there are some clients like that. Most people are like, "We want them to sign up. We want conversions. 100%. We've got 5% of our subscribers upgrading to the higher price package. We want 8% to upgrade to the higher price package." Right? Everybody, business is magical thinking. A bunch of people sit in a room and they go, "All right, 5% of our customers are buying this. We want 7%.
Right.
And how are you going to make that happen? Well, now that we've all agreed we want 7%, let's figure out how to make that happen. And then they do.
Yes.
If you don't set the goal, then nothing happens.
Yeah, it becomes a reverse engineering process once you define the outcome.
And so,
right?
And so it's not dirty to say, "I'd like to talk to my old friend." It's not dirty to say, "Oh, and by the way, is there something I might want from this?" As long as you're upfront, you're not going like, "I hate this person, but I'm going to buy them lunch so I can trick them into doing me a favor." No, not like that. But just, "I like this person. We haven't spoken in a while. By the way, I wonder what work they're doing. Maybe there's a place for me in it. Maybe not. But let's just talk and I'll tell them what I'm doing." And like you said, it might spark something. And and I think you taught me it's okay to... I went to an old, a former client, not an old client, they're not an old person, but a former client. And I said up front, I actually said, "Here's what I'd like from this." Because they were basically picking my brain for free advice. They couldn't afford me, but they wanted my advice. And I said, "I have no problem with that. And I'm happy to do it for you. We're friends. I like you. I love this product. And I'd love to spend 30 minutes talking to you about it. That's fun. That's fun for me. Some people collect stamps. This is what I do. Not a problem. But since I've started this agency and I am looking for clients, if you have a friend who's working at a company like yours, with values like yours that would align with what you know about my values, and you can introduce me to that person, I wouldn't say no to that either. So basically, it was tit for tat. It wasn't tit for tat. I was going to do it anyway, but I did let them know, you know, if they were thinking, well, you're just getting, you're just like, yeah, let's put our cards on the table. Let's be real about this. We both need to survive. This is capitalism. There's not the state doesn't give everybody money from heaven every month. We have to earn it. Yeah. And the work that we do, fortunately, is pleasant. So let's help each other get some more of that pleasant work. There's nothing wrong 100%. With saying that. And you taught me that. You taught me it's okay to do that because I had all kinds of weird, I won't say moral qualms because that implies there's something immoral about being, it's just be truthful. Yeah, it's a hang-up.
It's the hang-up. I agree.
It's like people who don't let you know what they do. There's a lot of people who just say, oh, I wish I could be a self-promoter. And I'm like, guess what? People used to say to me, you really, you know, you're pretty good at self-promotion. And I said, well, yes, because I don't have a rich uncle who's promoting me. And if I don't let people know what I'm doing, if I don't let people know about web standards and these other people don't let people know about web standards, guess what? It's not going to happen. And now that more people know about that, if I don't let them know that I'm available to work, then I'm not going to get the work. And then what?
Yeah.
I'll go back to washing dishes at a vegan restaurant. That will suck. Yeah. That's not what I want. You have nightmares about the soap bubbles and carrots and the soap. It's just, it's not good.
I'll make a gross, gross generalization. So forgive me for this being so broad, but I do believe that outside of our industry, in more traditional industries, finance, corporate environments, healthcare, whatever, people are much more forthcoming about the fact that business relationships are transactionally positive for like everybody involved, and they don't apologize for it. Like, there's a lot more forthrightness about like, hey, I'd love to meet you because I really want to meet this person that I know you know, and it would be mutually beneficial for both of us if we could make this connection or make this introduction. Like, people don't join country clubs to go golfing. Like, they join country clubs for the connections.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah,
I did not know.
Our industry,
because we have this sort of hippie,
very sensitive, very, very deliberate, 100%. I agree with you entirely.
I remember when Marcy started working with Eric and me on an event apart, and she said, well, where's your mailing list? And we said, well, we don't collect people's names and addresses. She said, and we were like, heaven for fend. You know, and I laugh about it now, but it was like, just because they gave us money to come see our show doesn't mean they want to hear from us again. She's maybe they do. Give them the opportunity.
Oh, sure. I had a client say to me one time,
we didn't think
as
that
I was
way.
Explaining to them, Greg Story, when we were at Happy Cog together, Greg Story had a vision for outbound sales that was like revolutionary for us because of the relationship and the reputation you built. Most sales at Happy Cog was inbound. It came in to us from people that wanted to work with us.
Thank you.
And Greg Story got scared because he saw more and more higher education projects were coming in, more and more and more and more and more. And he was envisioning, you know, man, if we don't do something in 3 years, we're going to be exclusively working with universities because that's all that's coming. And we need to reach out to people. We need to, you know, again, be intentional, figure out that we want to work with Disney Resorts and reach out to Disney Resorts and let them know we'd love to work with them and make our intentions clear and just be really deliberate and forthright and put your foot on the gas and, you know, speak that into reality. And I would have, you know, never wrapped my arms around that if Greg hadn't been banging that drum. But then here I am years later in my consulting saying something similar to my clients, like, listen, you know, make a list of all the companies you want to work with. Like, who are they? What do they look like? What do they have in common? You know, like, you want to work with outdoor lifestyle brands. Like, that is who you want to work with. Everybody you just described in your list was some version of, you know, Yeti or something else that was like built around this outdoor lifestyle kind of attitude. Like, all right, let's create a list and start to reach out to those people. And one of my clients said, like, are we allowed to do that? Like, are we allowed to just email people unsolicited? Isn't that spam? Like, aren't we basically spamming these people? And I said, you know, you have to just lean into this a little bit and put this information out there. If they don't want to hear from you, then they'll certainly let you know they don't want to hear from you. But if you don't, you know, it's that Wayne Gretzky saying, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. So you have to eventually develop this willingness to give it a try and also realize that
hard for shy people. What's your advice for shy people?
I think that it is hard for shy people. I think it's also incredibly disappointing if you finally, you know, generate the courage to do it and you don't feel an immediate, you don't see an immediate response. I would say,
which you usually don't.
And that's exactly it.
It doesn't work magically the first time.
100%. 100%. I would encourage anybody that has any reservations about this to adopt a very, very, very long-term view of this. It is just going to take an extraordinary amount of time. Like I said, it's very uncommon you're going to drop an email on somebody on this magical day where they're thrilled to hear from you and they're going to respond. I mean, that can happen, and that's wonderful when it does. But if you approach it more in this attitude of this is just going to take time, I'm going to have to develop this relationship slowly and kind of methodically over a long period of time. And I think the best way for a shy person to get over that is focus on being generous and offering value to these people.
Yes.
You are smart. You do smart work. You have tools you use. You have, you know, things that you apply to your work that a client would be happy to hear about. They would find valuable. I think we lose sight of the fact that this is the thing I learned too in my consulting work. I wind up talking to a lot of my clients' clients. I wind up talking to a lot of brands and product companies and people that hire my clients. And a recurring theme among those folks is, listen, you know, I've been working for the Met Museum now for 10 years. 10 wow. years ago, I was a web designer and I read a list apart and I paid attention to all these things and I went to web conferences. 10 years into my career here, I go to museum conferences now. Like, I'm much more focused on the industry I work in than I am on the craft. I rely on smart people that are generous to bring me interesting things like this tool we use for organizing content or this spreadsheet we created for organizing content. Like, it can be fairly pedestrian stuff like that you take for granted. Like, I don't know, it's not that big a deal. I have this spreadsheet I created that, you know, organizes content. I saw Jeremy Keith tweeted about this recently, like, and maybe not recently, but like maybe in the fall of last year. He had this perfect tweet. It was a photo of a spreadsheet he used to organize either content types or something related to, you know, the way that he had to think through content. And there was a link where you could download it. And it was just him being very generous about this fairly, you know, ground level resource that he just found useful. That was wonderfully generous of him. So bring some of that to your communication with clients. Like, hey, Jeffrey, I know it's been several months since we last spoke, since I reached out to you last, or since we last talked, I was thinking about you just because I know that, you know, you have to organize a ton of content working at Thomson Reuters or wherever the hell you work, right? My company uses this simple spreadsheet to organize content for content architecture for, you know, whatever we use it for. I just thought you might find it handy. We've shared it with a few of our active clients. I thought you might find it valuable as well. I really hope you're doing well. You know, I'll check in with you maybe at the end of the year and see how things are going, blah, 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 blah. I didn't ask for a meeting. I didn't ask them for a phone call. I didn't ask them for a project. All I did was be generous and sincere. You know, it was also not a pain in the ass drip campaign, insert first name, boilerplate copy. You know, it was an email I sat down and wrote to you, and people can pick up on that.
That's super important. That's super important. It doesn't have to be long. It doesn't have to be a masterpiece of literature. It shouldn't be. They don't have time. But a sincere, hey, saw this, remembered a conversation we had about, about you like Orson Welles, I like Orson Welles. Here's this interview with Orson Welles.
Sure.
Hope all's well.
Yeah. Or I just saw this press release that, you know, your company's doing this thing and it made me think of this. You know, a lot of the hardest part I find in business development for a lot of owners is they don't have tons of time to work on business development. They're very busy. They're very busy in the work. They're very busy in every aspect of the work. And it's just hard to manufacture more time to do these things.
Well, in the last year, that's basically all I did.
Yeah.
I will say.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because I started my own studio in part because I really wanted to get my hands dirty doing a lot of the work myself again. And then for the last year, basically, I certainly didn't open Sketch and I didn't write any CSS. And, you know, I did some research. I wrote some papers. I did a lot of client communications. And that work is creative too. And I liked it.
It is nothing wrong
with that. And I mean, this is what you do, right? Communicating with people. There's something really beautiful about that.
If you're an agency owner and you realize you're only going to have 15 minutes to work on biz dev, you know, in the middle of the afternoon on Tuesday when a client canceled a meeting on you and you have this like sudden pocket of time where you can spend some time. I'd rather you spent 15 minutes writing three thoughtful emails than 15 minutes pressing deploy on 10,000 spammy pain in the ass emails trying to generate work. Right. Like, I think that kind of deliberateness and that kind of that thoughtfulness pays off in the long run. And so I think it's just, again, it's a matter of adopting a posture of, I think we also start to, we build the wrong kind of speed in our minds, because oftentimes when people start an agency, it's because they're doing good work and there's enough good work now to employ like four people. Right. And now there's enough good work to employ eight people. And it's all coming in through referrals. It's coming in through organic. That is very much the way that a designer becomes an entrepreneur, is because they are dragged into developing a team because there's opportunities they want to tackle. They need a bigger team and they kind
of, and it becomes the Peter principle too. You get promoted to the part, you can get promoted to a place where you're incompetent.
100%. I think that's the exact same analogy applies to, you get to a point where you grow beyond what you can, what your organic biz dev is good for. Like, you get to a size where it's like this organic stuff that comes in just naturally isn't, I often say that organic inbound like leads, they're like the Tyrannosaurus Rex in Jurassic Park. It's going to eat when it wants to eat, and it's going to shit when it wants to shit, and it's not going to follow the park rules. Like, there's just no dependability when it comes to biz dev. It just has its own ebb and flow, and it's terrifying. So I think what happens is if people, you know, grow in that kind of organic internal biz dev, you get used to things that close quickly because someone reached out to you. They reached out to you because they have a project, they have a budget, they have a problem, they thought of you, you know, they're already ready to like think about a project. And maybe it takes weeks to turn that initial conversation into getting started because they had something, they came to you with a need. When you do outbound and you're reaching out to people, they don't have that need. They don't have an acute need. You are reaching out to them in between when they need someone. So you just have to kind of give yourself the time and the forgiveness that like, it's just going to take a little bit more time to get to the finish line here because they're not coming at me with something. They don't have an emergency that they're trying to answer. I am reaching out to them when they're in like a restful state, and I have to be dedicated long term enough that I'll be there when they do need me. So I think if someone's more on the shy side and it's hard for them to do this, I think they have to give themselves a lot of grace and give themselves a lot of time to work this out, and not, you know, don't be so hard on yourself if you wrote this email and you got a, hey, we're not interested right now. That's going to happen. Like, if you write this email and no one responds, that's going to happen. You just have to, just dedicate yourself to the longer term, not sweat the little hiccups along the way. And I'm sure that eventually, you know, the clouds part a little bit, someone wants to have a meeting or someone refers you or something happens that's a positive result.
If you're, that is really good advice. If you're, people don't realize this, but I'm very shy. I love people, but I also need to recharge my batteries a lot after talking to me. Even my best friends, I need to like just chill. Yeah. One thing you can do is just make yourself a to-do list every day. And just if at the end of the day, you can check off five things that you did to help your career, five things that you did to line up a job or line up a gig, doesn't matter if they bore fruit or not. You'll get the sense of achievement that way. If you're going, I can only do this five times, and if I don't get a gig, I'm quitting. No, you can just go, I've done five things for my career today. I'll do five things tomorrow and five things the next day. It's like starting an exercise program, and you write down how many reps you've done, and you don't expect to turn into an Adonis right away, but you just keep going. You just keep going, and over time, it will pay off.
I love that idea. I think that a lot of folks will not spend time in business development because they'll spend time in billable time. Right. They'll spend time in client work. They'll spend time, you know, like, oh, I really don't have an hour to do that because I have to spend my time in billable time because that's how I get paid.
Then you're limited to your inbound links, exactly 100%. What the Greg story thing was that you were talking about before. Yep. Then you're, if you've only got three clients and they don't treat you very well and they don't pay you enough, they're going to keep you busy and you'll keep getting billable hours, but you're never going to move on to a better class of problem to solve, a better client relationship.
But I think if you make that list, like you talked about, like, these are the five things I hope to work on today that'll whatever, you know, improve my career or generate a new project or whatever. The simple act of putting that list together is a reminder to you, like, hey, you know, you've not checked anything off this list in the past like 3 days. You need to start to make some time to do some of this work, because this is a glaring reminder. This unchecked list is staring you right in the face, telling you, you know, you need to do this. If you don't do that, if you don't put it down on paper or commit it in some way, then it's easy to kind of give yourself the false positive of, well, you know, I'm working really hard. Like, I may not be doing any biz dev. I may not really be marketing myself at all, but man, I am working really, really, really hard. And, you know, that's its own reward, and that'll pay off somehow too. I think you can really charm yourself or romance yourself into the idea of, like, I am killing it over here. I am working as hard as I can.
You can trick
it. I'm not really spending my time in all the areas I should.
You can also trick yourself. I know people who confuse activity with achievement. I can do that too. I think we can all be sorry. I've got a cold. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You can all just go, I did this and this and this and this and this and this and this. And, you know, none of it actually helped. So focus on things that'll move the needle and bounce off someone like you. Find someone like you. Joe Rinaldi's a good choice, by the way, folks, but,
thank you.
but if it's not Joe Rinaldi, find someone you trust who has your best interest at heart, or you can say, who will just tell you the truth if you're kidding yourself. If they hear you maybe kidding yourself, we'll say, listen, you know your own life best, but it sounds to me like maybe you're confusing activity with achievement. Maybe, you know, maybe the checklist is now a drug, and it's time for you to go cold turkey and try a different way.
Yep. I couldn't do half the stuff I do if I didn't work with Raul Anders, who's another ex-Happy Cog collaborator and friend. And Raul and I work on a bunch of these projects together. I couldn't do half of this if I didn't have him, you know, as a partner in lots of this, just figuring this stuff out and holding me accountable. So, you know, find another agency owner that you can relate to, that you can commiserate with and hold each other accountable. It's a very lonely place at times, running a studio or running a team or leading a team. It can be a very cold mountain to be on the top of.
Yes.
So, you know, if you can find someone else, maybe they're in client services, but you're a dev shop and they're an SEO firm, or just, you know, you're not competitive in any way. You just live in different worlds doing the same kind of client service work. If you can find somebody like that, that you can, you know, get together with once a month, keep each other honest about the time you know you need to spend in business development, hold each other accountable. That's a great first step. That just gives you at least someone else that you can bounce ideas off of, and someone else that can hold you accountable. A buddy, just a buddy. You just need someone that gets it. And it's hard because, like, your spouse may not get it, or friends that you have that don't work in this space may not get it. Very, very, very smart people who you trust implicitly.
Right. You can ruin your marriage. You can ruin your marriage telling your partner all this stuff that really they can't help you with, and they get sick of hearing, but 100%. someone else in the same line of work doesn't get sick of hearing it because they're dealing with exactly the same stuff. And it's they hear all the subtle differences of what you're saying.
Exactly.
Instead
they understand
the constant whining. Right. Yeah. And even someone who loves you can hear constant whining.
It's a very specific kind of context doing this work with clients, all of that. And I think, you know, people that do it get it. People that do this kind of work get it. They share that kind of secret language. And if you could find somebody that gets it, then you can get to the heart of what's bothering you without having to spend 45 minutes explaining why this is important and the context behind this and, you know, the sequence of things that led to this and what I've learned in my life. You can just get right to the heart of it and say, you know, this client came in and they totally swooped and pooped at the end of this project. They were, you know, I didn't hear from the entire project. I didn't even know they were important. And they come in on the last day and came in and changed everything. I get that. Like, right out of the gate, like, someone that does this work can commiserate and say, oh man, I totally can relate to how miserable that can be. I think you need people that understand that.
Yep. I value my relationship with you, not only because of our friendship, which I enjoy very much, but also because of the actual stuff, like you talked about. I'm just being honest. Like you have helped me. And I think you have taught me to be honest, and you have helped me also just ask for help when I need it. And I think being confident, being intentional, a word that I get from you that you use a lot, what do I want out of this? What am I trying to achieve? Visualizing what you want, doesn't mm-hmm. mean it's magical, and it doesn't mean it's not a level playing field. Some people have, you know, more privilege than others. Some people have more luck than others. Some people have more talent than others. That said, everyone can visualize. Everyone can say, here's what I want. If you get up in the morning knowing what you're going to try to achieve, you have a much better shot at actually achieving it. And I get a lot of that from you. So Joe Rinaldi of Clutch, thank you. First time on the show. Definitely going to have you back again because there's lots more to discuss. Thank you, sir. Thank you for being you, and have a great day.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jeffrey.